with these riders. But right now we're getting her from Debbie Alsdorf, so please help me welcome her up to the podium. Hi. I am so happy to be here. And I'm a little ADD, sorry. I don't think I've ever been diagnosed, but I think I am. Anyway, I'm so happy to be here, and so true confession immediately right out the chute. Like, so I have never spoken at a writer's conference. There you have it. So, and I'm very thrilled about this, and I'm going to be telling you why a little bit tonight, as I'm going to be talking about my journey into being a published writer and what that entailed and how God was working behind the scenes and why I do what I do. And though I speak literally all over the world, and that's what I do for a job. This is what I do. I'm a full-time speaker and writer. But to tell you the truth, as I prayed and as I prepared and as I thought of who would be here this weekend, I am more excited about you all than any group I go to. And the reason is because you guys are investing your life into wanting to be able to provide something that will inspire other people, that will make them think, that will help them connect them to God. And you guys are the game changers. You guys are the difference makers. And so it's really exciting, and it's a privilege for me to be able to be here and to share with you tonight. So tonight I'm just going to be talking about my journey into writing. And honestly, there's two kinds of writers, I think. Some people come by writing naturally, and maybe that's a lot of you. Maybe you like to read a lot as children. You grew up writing poems, writing stories, writing in your journals. You got A's on all your English tests. I don't know. You just love to create with words. And some of you have always just kind of had that gift, that art of wordsmithing a story or an idea. And for people like you, if you fit into this category, it's no surprise that you've wanted to be a writer. And it's no surprise to anybody around you that you are investing in being a writer, and that that's what you do, because this is always who you were. That's one category of writers. Then there's another category of people who write, and I would be the one that fits into this second category. There are people that are not born writers. They just aren't. They didn't get A's on every test. They didn't write when they were growing up. They didn't love to think of words, and they didn't even keep a journal. So that's me. And I am in that second category for sure. In fact, I used to have this little thing that I thought was kind of cute that I would always say, well, I'm not really a writer. And one of my publishers, after about the fifth project, said, could you please quit saying that? But the truth is, if you would have told me 13 years ago that I would be speaking at a writer's conference, I would think that that was pretty hysterical. I mean, I at that time, I started, you know, kind of tinkering and attending writer's conferences just because of the way and the direction that God was leading my life in ministry. But speaking at a writer's conference, that would just be absolutely ridiculous, because 13 years ago, I had never thought of writing. I didn't have anything published. It would have been the very furthest thing from my little pea brain, but 13 years down the road, I have been blessed to have 13 full-length things published by recognized publishers. And tonight I want to tell you how that happened, because what I want to inspire in your heart tonight, what God has put on my heart to inspire into your heart tonight, is the truth out of Ephesians 1:11 that says that in Him we've been predestined to conform to His plan, that we serve a God that conforms everything to the purpose of His will. So if you don't hear anything else I say tonight, and I hope you remember a couple things, but this is the most important thing. You serve a God, I serve a God who conforms everything to the purpose of His will. Our lives are not our own. We're a part of a bigger picture and a grander story. And the sooner we can latch onto that and learn that more and more, the more we will find excitement and the more we will find actual joy in watching how God is moving our lives, our individual lives in ministry and writing and whatever He's called you to do, along a continuum that is bigger than us. And I don't know about you, but I have spent a lot of years doing things that is just about me, and I want to live a life that is bigger than me. And I bet some of you would like to do that also. So, as I look back, though, people say, well, when did you want to be a writer? When did you start writing? And it's like, well, kind of never. That was like never my dream. I grew up and I was a singer, and I don't do that anymore, and now I'm a writer. And it's just interesting how God just changes your life. I'm very thrilled with what I get to do. But when people say, when did this happen, I'd always be like, well, it kind of happened by accident. And I'll tell you about that in a minute. It really did happen by accident. And there's a reason I want to tell you my story, because I want it to inspire faith in you and God's bigger plans. But as now, last week I was thinking about this weekend, and I was thinking of timeline. I love to think of timeline. I love to look back, and I love to see God's hand in different aspects of my life. The hand that you can't see when you're in the middle of it. Like today, we might not see his hand right where we are this minute, but 5 years from now, you'll look back on today, and you'll go, something pivotal happened at that point in time in my life that furthered me into where God was taking me. So when I was a younger woman, I was a senior pastor's wife at a very young age. We planted a church in Central California, moved from Southern California to plant this church, and the church grew big, and it was a mega church in the days before mega churches. So it was a really big church, and we were very young to be thrown into this fishbowl existence. Well, unfortunately, that marriage did end up in divorce after 12 years in the pastorate, and that's like a whole other story that God redeemed. However, what I want to tell you is, as a young pastor's wife, I vividly now remember the day. I can almost picture the day. We all had our little toddlers, me and a few of the other pastor's wives. We were all very young with our little kids, and we were at McDonald's Playland. And we were visiting, and the kids were on the structures playing. When everybody started getting real, because you see, there was nothing real about the life we lived. We all thought we needed to be pretty perfect and polished for Jesus, because let's face it, the culture that we live in, America and Western Christianity, everything's pretty perfect and polished. I'm going to be pretty and perfect and polished for Jesus. I'm going to learn to say the right thing, do the right thing, and give him the glory that way. Do you know what I'm talking about? This is the world that we live in, and it goes right into our Christian life and churches with us. And so we were all living that little, you know, pretty perfect and polished pastor's life existence. And this one particular day, one of the women was having a little bit of a struggle, and so she cracked open her heart just a little bit to us, and then the floodgates kind of went for everybody. And I sat there as being the leader, as young as I was, but feeling that responsibility that I was the key leader here, and I was listening to everybody, and I was realizing, like, wow, we don't know what we're doing. We really don't know. I mean, we're a church of 3,000 people. We do not know what we're doing. We are so messed up. And what some of the admittance was something like, there really has to be something more. Like, don't you guys struggle with fear? Do you, like, I like to worry so much, and then I go to church and act like I never worry, and, you know, like, I act like my marriage is good and it's really bad, or whatever it was that they were just opening up about that morning. And I sat there thinking, yikes, Jesus, there has to be something more for us. And so as we were leaving and hugging each other goodbye, I kind of had this sense of, like, perfectionism, responsibility, like I had to say something, I had to fix it. So I remember vividly that I said to them, as I had my little kids in my arms, I said, it's okay, girls, we're going to figure it out. Like, I'm going to find out what we got to do to get deeper. And you know what? Maybe I'll even write a book about it, and it will be called The Beginning of Something Deeper. Bye-bye. And I ran off with my kids, and we all thought that was funny. At the time, because what we all really wanted was to have something deeper in our lives and to have more meaning. Fast forward many years, in many very dark soul of the night experiences, and little did I know that God was planting that seed in my heart way back then, but that to get to the beginning of something deeper, he was going to allow my life to go through a lot of really hard stuff. And through that really hard stuff, he was going to bring me to a place that I always wanted to be. and the place wasn't about perfection. The place had nothing to do with pretty, perfect, and polished. The place had to do with broken, transparent, open, and honest. I didn't want to be her. I wanted to be a little more slick than that. So in the beginning of my relationship with Christ, you see, I never knew that it was possible to have the kind of relationship that I ended up having with him as a result of the brokenness. But writing? No, I didn't even keep a journal. Maybe I started keeping a journal a little bit, but part of the reason that it never occurred to me to write is because I still had a silly notion that Christian writers had it figured out. I still had this notion that I still, like, I'm in this place of restoration and God just picking up the pieces and redeeming them and becoming more real to me than I ever thought he could be, and joy despite my life falling apart. But I still thought that someday I would figure it out still, and when I figured it out, then I would be fit for this thing like writing or ministering or telling somebody else about the story. So I thought I had very little to offer in the way of helping people or writing to inspire others. The reason I bring up that point is because some of you might feel like you have very little to offer in the ability to inspire others. Maybe you know you can write, but you might feel that you really have very little to offer because maybe you can write something really eloquent, but then you go live the next day and it's a mess. Not your writing, but your day. And you think, what would I have to offer anybody, right? And so that is the myth that I want to just break down in the very beginning here, because you know what? Jesus never called us to be perfect people. He called us to be followers. And he called us to be followers so that he could do something different in our life by his spirit and his power, not by anything too much that we could bring to the table. Although that might sound a little confusing, because in another session I will be talking about what you really do have to bring to the table as far as time and energy and commitment. But because I didn't think that I had anything to offer other people, I was just a woman who was happy to be pulled out of the pit, to tell you the truth, because I knew pain. I knew the pain of some very real life stuff like rejection and divorce and ministry failure and remarriage and step-parenting. I mean, I never grew up dreaming that I was going to be the wicked stepmom, right? I mean, I know that's in fairy tales, but that wasn't my idea of a good, happy life. And unfortunately, I know the pain in the pit of clinical depression. No one in my family has ever been clinically depressed. That is a pit I never thought I would wind up in. But I did, and God pulled me out. And he was good, but it was long, and it was hard. And it was in those long and hard days that God began pouring the foundation for everything he wanted me to do until I take my last breath. I'm quite certain of it. And so we need to be encouraged that though our lives are not perfect, and though sometimes our situations are not pretty, that we serve a God who conforms everything to the purpose of his will. As we look to him, as we surrender to him, and as we seek his face, you could be in the darkest, hardest place, and God will use that place, if you stick with it, to help other people, to inspire other people, and to bring him glory. So, I'm somebody that was called the accidental author, and when I said that it happened by accident, it really did. There was a newspaper article done on me several years back in the Bay Area, and it was actually, I couldn't find it in our file in the garage because everything was just like garages. Do you have garages that are perfect, or are they like mine? Well, I couldn't get to this file cabinet. I wanted to bring it to you and show you because it's hilarious, because it says, accidental author shares God's word. It seriously was on the front page of the local newspaper. They must have not had any news that weekend. I don't know. But let me tell you how my journey began. Besides God planting the seed in the early 80s that I'm going to find out how we go deeper. and girls, I'm going to write a book. Like, why did I ever say that? Like, I didn't write a book. I didn't even read books back then. But for me, God planted seeds. There must be something more. That happened in the early 80s. And then circumstances began to prepare me for his work. So I want you to follow along with me here, and I want you to think about your life, because that's what's really important here. God has been planting seeds in your life. Think about them for a moment. I don't know what your seeds are. But God has been planting seeds, or a seed, in your life for a while. Now, circumstances in your life are preparing you to do his work. Now, that might mean that circumstances sometime aren't the greatest circumstances, but whatever it is, circumstances are preparing you for his work. Little did I know that it would be the crashing of my personal world that would plunge me into something deeper, which was the original seed that he put in my life. But God, circumstances prepare us, and time and trial grows the seed and establishes the plant. So for me, years of hardship, even depression, certain that I would never be useful or be in ministry again, but then Jesus began to woo me. He began to woo me, and I didn't care if I was ever in ministry again. I just wanted to be with him. And he began healing me. And he lifted me with his mighty strong arms out of a pit, that was too big for me. I love when David says in Psalm 40, I waited patiently for the Lord. He turned to me and he heard my cry. He lifted me out of the slimy pit, out of the mud and the mire, and he set my feet on a rock, and he gave me a firm place to stand. He put a new song in my mouth, a hymn of praise to our God. And many will see this and fear and put their trust in the Lord. And so I'm wondering if any of you have been in a pit. Maybe not a slimy mud pit, but in a really difficult place. And that maybe as you're in that place, that those circumstances of test and trial are doing the work that your Heavenly Father knows needs to happen in you to prepare you for the very thing that he has planned you for. God's work and my circumstances then intersected. And what happened was, is that after years of not being in ministry, I went through a divorce, I remarried, I worked in the corporate world as a trainer, a product trainer, and then I started getting this, I was having all of this, like 8 years of this personal time with God, the first time in my life I ever kept a journal. He was showing me so much about his love, and it wasn't to share, it was just between me and him. And it was changing me, it was healing me, it was delivering me, and I started getting the idea that I wanted to speak to women. Well, I was from Southern California, then Central California. Now I lived in Northern California, and I had no idea how do you speak to women. I mean, I didn't even know anybody in my local church at that time. We just went and sat in the back of a big church. I didn't know. And so I began to pray. Jesus, if this is you, and you want me to do this, show me how. Some of you, that can be the biggest thing that you take away from this weekend. If this is you, and you've planted seeds, and you want me to do this, and it's going to conform to your will, show me how. And so I began praying, and I prayed a big prayer that, God, if you want me to do this, then I just pray that you open doors, because I don't know anybody in the Bay Area, and I wouldn't even know how to go about this. Well, the strangest thing happened. About a week later, I get a call from a conference that happens at the Santa Rosa Marriott, a California women's retreat. I had never heard of it. I was new to the area. But somebody who was on their board used to be from our church in Bakersfield. And she heard I moved to the Bay Area. And so at one of their meetings, she said, I need to find her, my old pastor's wife. She could come and she can speak. So I get this call out of the clear blue, after years not being in the ministry, could you come speak at this women's conference? And I didn't even have to pray about it, because why? I'd already been praying about it. And I said, yes, I would be delighted to do that. Back then, they used to have it at Santa Rosa Marriott and the Santa Clara Marriott. And that was the first time that I spoke in many, many years. And from that one single phone call, then I started getting requests to speak at other churches. From one of the churches that I spoke at their women's retreat, their pastor contacted me and asked me if I would join his staff. And so then I spent the next 15 years of my life on staff at a large church in the Bay Area as their director of women's ministry. There's a reason I'm telling you this. You see, my circumstances and God's will and the experiences he allowed me to go through and the brokenness intersected. When God called me back into ministry, I was very afraid. I took 5 months to give this pastor an answer, and he just waited. And I was just so afraid. I'd been hurt in ministry. I really did not want to be hurt in ministry again, and I was afraid to do it. And plus, I had lost a lot of confidence in the years. It was okay to be me and Jesus, just me and Jesus, but tried putting it out there. And when I prayed about it, I felt like the Lord said to me that you're only going back into ministry if you will be real and you will be an open book. Well, now I'm even more afraid. Because I just spent the last because I didn't want anyone to know about me. This is how much I wanted the pretty, perfect, and polished thing. And I used to be embarrassed to share this, but I'm not embarrassed now because I know people can relate to this. But we used to take our little blended family. My new husband had two little girls. I had two little boys. The kids were all about the same age. They were like every year for 4 years, so in a four-year age range. We would take them to the church we were going to at the time, and we would tell them the weekend that we would have the girls and we would have all four together, I would give them the little spiel. Now, you don't have to tell anybody, the Sunday school teachers say anything, that we're not a real family. Because we are a real family. Heaven forbid anybody think that these weren't my children and that they were stepchildren. I mean, everything was kind of like this undercover thing. So if God said to me, if you're going to go back in ministry, then you're going to be real and you're going to be transparent, you're going to be an open book, it's like that was so scary. Because I didn't want anyone to know that I was a pastor's wife whose husband left her for another woman. Who wants to tell anybody that? That is quite frankly embarrassing. I didn't want anyone to know that I went through the pit of clinical depression as a Christian. No, thank you. That was very embarrassing. I didn't want anyone to know that my stepdaughter thought that I was the wicked stepmother. That was really embarrassing. I just wanted to be pretty, perfect, and polished for Jesus. That's all I ever really wanted to be, right? And he said, if I call you back to ministry, you have to be honest. Because people live in the real world. And real people need real faith in a real God. They don't need platitudes. They're tired of cliches. They don't need verses thrown at them without meaning and application. They need to know how to take God's word and their relationship with Jesus Christ into the real world of ordinary, broken life. And I said yes. So I started May 1st, 1997, at this church. They had a little women's Bible study. It was a church at the time of about 500. When I resigned from my position, it was a church of 6,000. And so we had a lot of growth and a lot of ministry over those years. But when it was a church of 500, they had a small little women's ministry, and I was coming in to take that over. And I inherited this lovely team that they called their women's council of just amazing women. And they ended their season. I came on staff. I'd been a women's ministry director before as a pastor's wife, so I knew when we hit fall, we're up and running. This is game time in fall. So you plan all summer. Some of you know that whole routine. So we would have our meetings, and I like to theme things. I like to name things and theme things. And so we need to have a theme for the next year. And so I just shared my heart with them, and I said, here's the deal. I have just been through some really hard years. And by the way, I was diagnosed with liver disease when I was in my 20s and given 3 to 5 years to live. Since I'll be 58 this year, I think that isn't how I'm going to die, quite frankly, to tell you the truth. But anyway, so because of that diagnosis way in my 20s, I did take things like opportunity very seriously. So I shared with these women, I don't know if I'm going to be at this church for 1 season, 2 seasons, 3 seasons. I don't know, because my health is a variable. I said, but if I only get one shot with the women, if I only have 1 season, there's something that they have to know. They have to understand God's love for them, because nobody ever taught me that, and nobody ever explained it to me. And learning God's love for me is radically changed my life, and that's what I want them to know. And they all said, that sounds great. So we all dispersed over the next week looking for materials. Well, back in 1997, there wasn't a lot of material on God's love for women. There is much more out there now. There was really nothing on it then. I can still remember vividly that I was driving home from Berean Bookstore in San Jose, and I lived in Pleasanton at the time, and I'm driving home in my little minivan all by myself, and I'm really frustrated because there is just nothing that fits the bill. Nothing. And I'm driving home, and I feel this thing, I hear this voice inside of me in my head. You know what I'm talking about. Not like crazy voice. You know what I'm talking about. And the words were, stop looking and start writing. Well, that was crazy. I just kept driving. Stop looking and start writing. Stop looking, start writing. I turn the radio louder. I don't know. I like had bad pizza or something for lunch. I don't know what's wrong here. Stop looking, stop writing. And I finally get home and I'm just like, God, is this you? Again, I hear it. Stop looking and start writing. And I sat in my minivan in front of my house and I said, but I'm not a writer. I don't even write. What are you thinking? Are you like, you know, what? And so I go home. I have four kids. I'm cooking dinner. And as I'm cooking dinner, I'm hearing it. I'm like stirring the pot. And it's like, stop looking, start writing. So finally, I tell my husband what's going on. I put the kids to bed. He goes to bed. And I tell the Lord, okay, I'm going to stay up. And if this is you, you're going to have to make it clear. Now, this might not be that encouraging to those of you that are real writers, but you know what? I'm just telling you my story. So I went into our room where the computer was. Everybody's asleep, and I literally did this. I don't know what made me do this, but I took a little vial of oil, and I anointed myself with oil. I anointed the computer and the keypad with oil, and I said, Jesus, if I'm supposed to stop looking and start writing, I ask you to do a work, as I will just stay up all night if I need to stay up just to know this is you. I ask you to fill me with your spirit, and I ask you to do something that I just couldn't possibly do myself. And I sat at that computer, and it started flowing, and it started seeming like it was coming together, and it had substance, and it had, it had a cadence to it. By the time it was morning, I wasn't tired, and I knew that I had met with the Lord, and that He had done something. And so I knew, okay, this is what we're going to do. I'm going to finish this. And I went to the little team, and I told them, like, I was so excited. Like, I'm really scared because I've never written anything. That must have made them feel great. But, you know, I did, you know, like, stay up all night, and I really feel like it's the Lord. That must have made them think I was a little bit crazy. And then they one by one bowed out of leadership. This to my friends today. It's not wasn't that kind of thing. It was just like they were not keen about grassroots curriculum. We could go buy something. We don't want to, like, do something that's not tested. Blah, blah. We're trying to build our women's ministry, Debbie. My own husband said to me, this fall season could make or break it with you at the church. I mean, your first season out, really? You want to do something you've written? Thanks, honey. Thanks for the vote of encouragement. I'm really scared. I went to my pastors, the senior pastor and the associate pastor. I made a meeting with them, and I told them what happened, and they said, well, sometimes you just have to walk by faith, so you just start to study even if you don't have a leader or a team behind you. Really? That is, and they looked at the material. They said, you need to do this. I'm like, this is not what I wanted to hear. So the reason I'm called the accidental author is this. We started in September with about 50 women. By the first week in November, we had copied over 800 copies of this homegrown curriculum off of our church copy machine. We later had to, like, get a new leased machine because we burnt that old one out. The middle of November, another newspaper came to me, and they called me, they said, can we interview you? And I'm like, why would you want to interview me? And they said, because something's happening with the women in the Bay Area, and it's being traced back to you. So I sat, I, like, let them interview me. I'm like, what are you hearing? And they're, like, hearing this crazy stuff. I wasn't keeping track. I was just trying to teach the local classes, but what was happening is women from other places were requesting now this homegrown curriculum. So that's why, though we had 500 women from 50 to 500 in 2 months in our weekly Bible study, and then we had hundreds of women other places doing this homegrown curriculum, and ladies and men, sorry, I'm so used to talking just to ladies. I said yes, I never have to write again. Isn't that the good news? You know, like, I mean, honestly, it wasn't anything that I wanted to do. Until I got a call from the state of California, Sacramento. I thought I was being arrested or something. I got a call, and the caller on the other line identified where they were from, and they said, we need to know if this is your material. And I'm like, well, it sounds like it from what you're reading. And I said, where did you get it? And she said to me, well, I need to tell you that this is being sent letter form into women's prisons all over the state of California, and we want to encourage you to please find an avenue to get this published. She gave me very specific directions. She said, you cannot self-publish. You cannot, you know, put it in a binder and send it in yourself. It has to be through a recognized trade book publisher so that it can get into the prisons. We're asking you to do this because women are responding. Good luck. Okay. Well, I never wanted to publish, but I'll tell you something. I have never been behind bars. I've never had a relative behind bars. But I have been behind different kind of bars. I've been behind the bars of depression and defeat and discouragement. I've been behind the bars of a life that did not turn out the way that I originally thought it would turn out. And I knew what that felt like. And I just, all I could think of was, God, it's not about me. If this could help women that are behind bars, then, Father, if this is your will, then show me what to do. I did not have one friend that was a writer. I did not know anybody in the publishing world. I went to the local library and looked up, how do you get published? That's funny. I realize now. How do you get published? Well, I found out a few things. I found out that I needed a list of publishers in my genre, Christian writing, women, Bible studies. Okay. Then I gathered that down. And then I found out that I also needed to write something called a query letter, which sounded a little queer to me. I didn't know what that was, but it told me what it was, right? And so, okay, so I have a list of Christian writers, I mean publishers, and their addresses, and I have a query letter that I followed the instructions and tried to write the best that I could. What it didn't tell me was this, that most publishers do not take unedited manuscripts, and most of them do not take unsolicited manuscripts. I had no idea. So I sent a giant stack of manila envelopes off to all these different Christian publishers with my little query letter and a couple of sample chapters of this Bible study. And they all came back to me. They would come back and they weren't even opened. They would come back with like a marker through them and it would say, return to sender, no unsolicited manuscripts accepted. One by one, coming back, and they were piling up where we kept our mail in this part of our kitchen. And this one day, my husband said, that looks a little messy, like maybe you should just get rid of them, except just save one, because I just know in my heart that God's going to publish this material so it can get into the prisons. And that was our focus, get it into the prisons. And I said, okay, I'll just save one and I'll throw the rest away. So I just randomly didn't look at the one I saved. I saved one and put it in a file. So a year later, I get a phone call at my office at the church that I worked at, and it was from David C. Cook Publishers, and they had my manuscript, and they wanted to know if I would be interested in a 2-book contract, maybe a 3-book contract. And I'm like thinking, what? And I'm like, so you have the Bible study? And they said, yes, this really has to be published. And I'm like, did the state of California call you? I mean, like, I didn't know what's going on. I mean, really, it was like the craziest thing. And she's like, no, why? And so then I told her. And she goes, no. And so anyway, so we start the process. I don't ask too many more questions because, like, I'm nervous, right? I'm like dealing with a real publisher. And they're saying, like, we'd like to think about publishing your stuff. So then they start saying things like, and we're going to do, but first we have to do a feasibility study. I said, what's a feasibility study? And then we want to see if it's feasible to publish you, because it costs money for us to publish you. And I'm like, oh, well, what do I have to do to be feasible? So they listed these things to have to do to be feasible, and I wasn't feasible, just for your record. And secondly, one of the big things to be feasible is I had to have people that could endorse me. My children, maybe, but they're teenagers. I mean, like, I had nobody to endorse me, and so it wasn't feasible. I told them I wasn't feasible. They seemed to just ignore that, and we went through the process. So the day that I got my contract, FedEx, we were going to have a celebration dinner. And so now our kids are all teenagers. My one son's just getting ready to go off to Biola, and we're sitting down to eat, and we make a really nice dinner when my husband goes, Debbie, go down to your file and get that manuscript, the envelope that I told you to save. Go get it, because kids, we want you to know that God conforms everything to the purpose of his will. We want you to see how all these envelopes came back and how God just did it anyway. You know, trying to teach our kids to trust God, right? And so I said, okay. And I go down to my office room and I go into my file and I pick up the thing and I'm like frozen. I'm like, what? It was from David C. Cook. And I had put tape on the back of the manila envelope so it hadn't been opened. It said return to sender. And the person's name that I sent it to was the same person's name that of the contract that I was getting ready to sign. So I walk into the dining room and I'm holding it up and I'm looking scared and they're like, what's wrong? I'm like, yeah, so this was never opened. And they're going, yeah. And I go, yeah, this was never opened and it says return to sender. And they're like, yeah. And I go, this is the same company that just sent me this contract. So how do we explain this? And we all just were stunned. The next next morning I called the publisher, because by now we're well into the editorial process. We have a relationship, me with the acquisitions editor, and I said to her, "So, how did you get my manuscript?" And she says, "Well, didn't you send it?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I did, but you see, it was returned to me, and I still have the sealed envelope. It was never opened, and it says return to sender, no unsolicited manuscript accepted." And well, back then, I don't know what they do now with all tech and everything, but back then they had a mail log. So she goes, "Oh, look into that." So I heard from her later in the day, and she said, "Well, yeah, you did send something in, and it was sent back to you. That's in our mail log." She goes, "So I don't know how I got it." She goes, "I'll tell you, I just came in one Monday morning, and this manuscript was on my desk with a sticky saying, 'You must publish this.'" And I'm like, "Who put it there?" Okay, I want you to hear something. I don't know a lot of people. I do now, but then I didn't know a lot of people. Who put it there? She didn't know. To this day, we still don't know. So then we got, yay God, right? We serve a God who conforms everything to the purpose of His will. So that's why I was dubbed the accidental author. But while we're in the feasibility process towards the end of the whole thing, they forget that I told them I was not feasible. I mean, I like tried to talk them out of publishing me originally. And so she says, "Well, now we need the people that you want this to go out for endorsement. It's going to be really important to have good endorsers because nobody knows you." In fact, the reason they gave me a 3-book deal is to give me market, to give me more on the shelf so people would think like I think I had something going on. I don't know, because nobody knew me. Crazy. So I said, "Well, I already told you I don't have anybody to endorse me. I mean, my mother's not even still alive. I don't have anyone to endorse me." And so they said, "Oh, yeah, you did tell me that. Okay, well, we got to really be thinking this through. Think it through." And they knew because I had told them about praying this whole way thing through. And so she's like, "You know, you pray about that and pray about those endorsers. Get your friends to pray about those endorsers. We'll figure this out." So the next day I'm on a walk with one of my close friends at the church. And we're on a walk, and I'm telling her, "We need to pray for endorsers. I have no idea who can endorse these Bible studies. And it seems to be a big deal to have a good endorsement." And so she goes, "Well, if you got to just tell the Lord, 'Jesus, this is who I would like to endorse my book, of anybody in the whole wide world, who would it be?'" And I'm like, "Oh, that's easy, Max Licato. It'd be Francine Rivers." And she goes, "Well, I don't know Francine, but I went to college with Denilyn and Max." And I'm like, "You never told me that." I go, "Are you still in touch with them?" She says, "Yeah." I'm like, "You never told me that." She goes, "I didn't know it was important. They're just accidental to me." And she goes, let me ask them if they'll take a look at it." So she called them. She said, "Would you take a look at this? They were busy. He didn't back then. Now he endorses things. Back then he didn't really endorse things." And so it was like, And she said, "Well, can I just send it?" And he's like, "Okay, I can't promise I'll look at it. We're busy, but..." Get this, the day they were moving. Okay, remember, God conforms everything according to the purpose of His will. My friend sends this out. They're moving. You know how when you're moving, sometimes you wait for the moving truck? They're in their garage with the garage. I mean, they're waiting. They have boxes around them. They're like in lawn chairs. The FedEx guy comes. They're like captive. There's nothing. They decide, "Well, let's look at this." So they look at it, and they decide, "We'll endorse it." So they endorsed it. And then the very same day, I get a call. Now, I don't know her, so don't be impressed. I get a call from Francine Rivers. And she says, "Somebody gave me your stuff. Can I help you get this published? Because it's very much like my book, Redeeming Love." It's, you know, because the Bible study then was called Steadfast Love. And I'm like, "Is this a joke?" She says, "No, what do you need? What do you need?" I go, "Well, it's already getting published, but I don't have endorsers." She goes, "I'll get them for you." She called Liz Curtis Hicks. So what I'm saying is, can you imagine? My publisher gives me a week to tell my friends to pray about it. Monday morning, I have Max Licato, Liz Curtis Hicks, and Francine Rivers. And they laugh and they go, "I thought you didn't know anybody." I go, "I don't. I really don't." So, why am I telling you all that? What's really important and why I'm telling you my story and why I delight in sharing that story is because God's always at work. And yes, I am an accidental author. And some of you are what I would consider, in my terms, real writers. And I think that's wonderful. And I think that you have to work in excellence with your craft. And over the years, I have become a real writer. Because what I always really wanted to write, I never thought of writing curriculums. But when God pulled me out of that pit and I realized what it took to go deeper with Him, I started having a desire to write about that. And so I really wanted to write that. I wanted to write my story of coming out of the pit because God used four truths in Psalm 139 to rock my world and change my life, and I wanted other women's worlds to be rocked and changed, and that's what I wanted to write. So after I was published, I kept trying to pitch this other book I wanted to write. And so this is my story. I kept hearing, you're not ready. It's not good enough. You have to learn how to write. Curriculum's one thing. Writing a full-length nonfiction book is a whole other thing. And I'd be like, but this is my passion and this is my heart. Help me. They'd go to writers' conferences. Okay, I'm going to them. Help me. And I remember this editor said to me, Debbie, your sentences have to sing. What does that mean? Like, you write a sentence and it sings a melody back to you. You write a paragraph and you feel the cadence of the music and you find your voice. How do I find my voice? I don't know, Debbie. You have to figure this out. You have to write and you have to write and rewrite and rewrite until you feel it singing a song back to you. And at first I was really discouraged, like, I will never grow up and be a real writer. But God works everything to conform to the purpose of His will. And He began working in me and teaching me, and to this day He keeps stretching me towards what I would call real writing. In the years in between, He gave me other opportunities. He gave me opportunities to be a staff writer for Focus on the Family, and I wrote several of their curriculums through Gospel Light, and gave me opportunity to feel like I was a real writer and I was making a living at being a real writer, but still I wanted to write this book. So after three proposals, 1997, now we're at 2007, after three proposals on this book, after me coming up with all kinds of titles, thinking that if I changed the title, that would change, that they would accept it, it finally was accepted. But that was years of writing, rewriting, writing, rewriting, reading it out loud. How do you know if it sings? Read it out loud. It has to sound good when you read it out loud. You have to be able to read it out loud to yourself, and it sounds like something that you would want to quote, that you would want to read. That not just a bunch of words that aren't going to mean anything, but something that is going to translate to other people. And so I finally got a book deal, not a curriculum deal, a book deal. And this time I was excited because this time I wanted to write. Why did I want to write? Because I saw how God used the three-series Bible study. I saw women's lives changed. I got letters from all over the place. I thought, oh my gosh, what a joy it would be to be able to inspire other people to be connected to Jesus Christ. That's why you're here, right? Whether you write fiction or nonfiction, it doesn't matter. All of it is turning the key in the same direction. But this is what's funny. The biggest thing that I have learned in my story, in journey into writing, is not being in control. I'm in control of the time that I'm going to write. I'm in control of the things that I give up during writing season, writing project. And you have to give up a lot. That's what people don't talk about very much. You give up a lot to write. But what I wasn't in control in was what the outcome was going to be. What I wasn't in control of is anybody would actually look at it or publish it. What I wasn't in control of is I birthed a baby and I called it something, then a publisher picks it up and they change the name every time. They do. In this case, that first book that was the book of my heart, that to this day is still the book of my heart, that book, my working title was Living as His, because I learned that I was His. I never knew I was His. I was a Christian. I was in ministry, but I didn't know who I belonged to. belonged to. My identity was all wrapped up in what I could do, not who I was in him. So my title was Living as His, and I thought that made perfect sense. And we went through the whole process, and then we're getting ready to go to the final stages of it, and they changed the title to one single word, and they were going to call the book Deeper. Now, I had forgotten about the McDonald Playland years ago until that day. They said the word deeper, and I didn't argue with it. I said, okay. I got off the phone, and I'm like, oh, my heaven. God, you are always working. You were working in the 80s when I said, I'm going to find out how, and I'm going to write a book called The Beginning of Something Deeper. Seriously. And here it is, 2007, and they say, by the way, we changed the title. We like the title Deeper. We aren't in control. Was this an accident? Am I really an accidental author, or was God always at work? Yes. At some point, I had to realize that somewhere inside of me, God had already made me a writer. I just didn't know it yet. And now I actually love to write. And like many of you, I love to read. It's my favorite pastime now. And I love to play with words. And I love to spin a story. And I love to be in my brain. Do you know what I'm talking about? Halfway through my life, God opened a whole new world and a whole new door. But he had always known that that was the path this part of my life would take. He had always known what it was going to take for that to unfold, because to be quite honest, if I hadn't gone through some of the stuff I'd gone through, I'd have nothing to write about. I don't mean like I'm like into it. Like I still wish I didn't go through it. Like I never wanted to be the poster child for Christian depression. Hi, my name's Debbie, and I'm a Christian, and I love Jesus, and I know all about clinical depression. Woo! I mean, you know, really. I'd rather be like, hi, I'm Debbie, and I'm victorious. You know, like, no, I'm baby stepping my way through trusting Jesus. But God knew. And so I'm wondering, what about you? God has prepared you for his plan. You might have some goals. You might have some ideas of what that plan might be, but what you need to know, and this is biblical truth, that God himself has invested in you, and he has prepared you, and is even right this moment preparing you for his plan. And it started from very young, because Psalm 139 says that when he knits you together in your mother's womb, that all the days ordained for you were written in his book before one of them came to be. And so that means that he has prepackaged you to use you as he has planned. So he has gifted you to fulfill his plan. Now, why do you need to hear this? Why do I always need to tell myself this? Is because it is silly and ridiculous to get prideful and heady about being a writer, okay? Because if you can write, and you can write well, and if you get a contract, and if your books sell, yay, the kingdom's expanded. But it's never, ever, ever about us. It's not about you. It's not about me. It's about a purpose bigger than ourselves. And when we can understand that, then we can take his hand as he leads us along paths that he's always been preparing. Because you see, every one of you have a history, and it might be completely different than the person sitting next to you, but your history is his story that's being played out in your life. And God invites you and me to join him in his plan. And that's a really exciting invitation. And when we say yes, then he opens doors that no man can shut. Now, it doesn't happen overnight. I just got to telling you deeper, I wanted to write that book for 8 years. I wanted to write, and you know, the funny thing about it is, I can see now, looking back, when I look back and I see how God took all those years in preparing me, he had to prepare many things about me, my heart, my ego, my mind, my life, my spiritual life, because once Deeper came out, then the next 4-book contract came, like, on its heels. And if I wasn't prepared, and if my foundation wasn't right in the Lord, you know what, that kind of thing can undo you instead of bless you. That God loved me enough to do the hard work of preparation. So if you're in the meantime, in between A and B, like, you know, A is my prayer, God, use me. B is you really believe he's going to, but you're like in between, and you're like, but when? Here I am, I'm trying. happening. Just trust him. Because he is a God that's all about timing. So, in the next session that I have with you, I want to talk about the spiritual life of the writer. Because our spiritual life, as you can tell by the things that I'm even sharing tonight, our spiritual life, believe it or not, is more important than our writing life. Because out of our spiritual life comes really great writing if we will trust God to pen his message through us. But I want to close my session tonight with a defining moment. I have had several defining moments in my life. I told you about, you know, the McDonald Land Park, the little land thing that I'll never forget. But I want to tell you about a defining moment that happened to me many years ago, and I still remember it vividly to this day, and it's something that happened with a little hamster named Jif. My son, my youngest son, when he was just 7 years old, all he wanted for his birthday was a hamster. I told him we don't do hamsters. We don't do rodents of any kind in our home. Now, I know technically they're not a rodent, but to me, hamster, rodent, they're all the same. We don't do hamsters. But I came home one day, the day of his birthday, and he was sitting on the front porch with a little cage with a little wheel in it with a giant smile on his face, and I had known what had happened. His favorite person in the world, Grandma, took him to get what the only thing her little grandson wanted for his birthday. So she overrided me and got Jif. When I walked up, there was a big sign out of butcher paper over our garage that said, "Welcome home, Jif," like they saw in their baby books when they were born. And he was sitting on the porch with a cage with a big giant smile on his face, and I love my little guy, so for the love of my son, we kept Jif. Now, there's a problem, though, with hamsters or any kind of pets like that, and that is that they smell, and they make a lot of noise, and your children tell you they'll take care of them and clean up after them, but we all know that is not true. That might last maybe the first week, and then forget it, right? Another thing about hamsters is they get lost, and then you can't find them. You don't know if they're dead somewhere. I mean, you know, they're just a mess, right? But the biggest issue for me was the noise of that squeaking wheel. Now, these days, I saw at PetSmart, they have hamster habitats. And on the beautiful box with the picture of all the little plastic, it says, "Whisper Soft Operation." So I guess they make a little hamster village for them, and all through the night, they can go through the tunnels and the grooves, and nobody can hear them. That's lovely. But when we had Jif, we had the squeaky wheel. So, at this point in my life, I had remarried. Nobody told me how hard a blended family was. One of those things nobody wants to speak up about. So now I'm in a blended family. If I thought life was hard before, now life is double hard. I'm happy to say that this year we celebrate our 23rd wedding anniversary, which is really 161 years of marriage because you do it in dog years, because that's how hard it is. So 161 years this August, but back then, we were in the early days, and I had my stepdaughters in one room, I had my sons in the next room with the hamster in the cage, and my husband and I were down the hall in our room, and everybody's sleeping soundly, and I'm trying to go to sleep the first night, and all I can hear is squeak, 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 and it was annoying, and I'm tossing and turning, and I'm really tired when I get up in the morning. Second night, everybody's sleeping soundly. Now I'm a little still tired from the night before, so the sound is magnified in my head. Squeak! Squeak! And I'm just like, oh, this hamster. I wake up in the morning and I'm grouchy. And the third night, I am tired from not having two nights sleep. We're going into the third night now. I know I'm going to have a third night with no sleep, right? And you know that saying, if mama ain't happy, try to go to bed. Everybody's sound asleep. And now all I can hear is, squeak, squeak. I mean, it's so loud. It's so exaggerated in my head. And finally, at 1 in the morning, I get up. I throw my robe on. I go down the hall. I go into the boys' room. And they have a little sign over the cage that says, "Home sweet home, Jif." By the way, his name was named after my son's favorite food, Jif peanut butter. And then there's a little towel, privacy towel, over his cage. We don't want to bother this little guy. And I, at 1 in the morning, with everybody asleep, go in and I take the privacy towel off the cage. And I do what any mother knows to do when there's a problem in the household. I get eye to eye. We do it with our kids. If we need to have a talk, I'm going to do it with a hamster at 1 in the morning. So I get eye to eye at his level with the hamster. And I say, "Jif, where are you going? Look, you're going round and round, Jif. You're not going anywhere, Jif. Stop, just stop. Where are you going?" And the more I talk to Jif, the faster and faster, more furious. He just stared at me and ran faster, 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 like he was like in a race. And I'm like, oh my God, my voice scared. stimulates him. And I just stood there and I just looked at him, and my kids were asleep, the girls were so asleep, and the hamster's running like a maniac, and I'm like, oh, God made you a nocturnal creature. I can't change that, but we're on a two-story, and there is a window right here, and I could just put you out the window, but I'm not that evil of a mother, so I couldn't do that. And then I thought, and there is a bathroom in the next room, and nobody, I've heard of people flushing hamsters down the toilet, and nobody would know. But I didn't have the guts to do that either, so instead, I went back to my room. I pulled the covers over my head. My husband's still asleep. I don't know how anyone didn't hear me arguing with the hamster. One-way conversation. I pulled the blankets over my head, and I began crying. I mean, I'm talking snot crying. I am bawling. My husband still doesn't wake up. And I start praying. I'm like, Jesus, I hate this hamster. I don't want him. Please take him. And then this is my defining moment. Clear as a bell, God spoke to me and he said, Debbie, you're just like Jip. You're just on a different wheel. Now God got my attention. Under my covers, I start driving. Run. Yeah, I've always ran. What do you mean? Gotta try harder. Gotta be better. Gotta do more. Good Christian. Good wife. Good stepmother. Good employee. Oh, good volunteer. Good whatever it was. Good den mommy. Whatever I did. Good, 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 good. I gotta try. Gotta be my best. Gotta go. And he said, you're tired. And this is the real part of the defining moment that sticks with me to this day, is Jesus reminded me of his call to come in Matthew 11:28. Come to me, all of you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Oh, I knew that verse. I even knew it was in Matthew 11:28. But as I sat there, I felt as if he ministered to me and said, Debbie, I want to make this real to you. Coming is turning in an entirely different direction. It's an action. This is not a cliche. This is my invitation to you to come near and come close and let me have everything and let me be your life and your peace. And I felt that that was an appropriate thing to share at the end of my talk with you tonight, because you can get on a wheel, especially at groups like this. It happens to me every time I go to a writer's conference, a speaker's conference, whatever I go to, my ideas start going crazy. Well, I could do this, I could do that, I could do this, I could do that. They're like, woo, you know, like, get going, going, going. And sometimes God's working and he's giving you the ideas. Sometimes we're just getting wrapped up in the whole thing. But the main thing is that you have to come to him. He's bidding you and bidding me to come closer, closer, closer still. And when we do, we will hear his voice, the God that conforms everything to the purpose of his will. Debbie, stop looking and start writing. We will hear his voice. We will have the courage to say yes to his voice. And then we will see a fruitful outcome, because it will be him and not us. Father, I just pray for all of us in this room, and I pray, Lord, that we would come to you in a new and a living way, no matter how long we've known you, no matter how much we've done for you, no matter how much we've served you. I pray that we would come to you in a new and living way. And Father, I thank you that you're a God that created us for your purposes, and that you're a God that works everything according to the purpose of your will. May your word not go void, and may we be encouraged, Lord, to trust you, to say yes to you, to believe that you are working behind the scenes in our lives. And Lord, make us writers. Make us good writers, that we might inspire other people to know you more. And I ask this, Lord, in your name. Amen.
That was wonderful. Wasn't that wonderful? Yes. Thank you so much, Debbie.